This week on From the Vault, we listen to the voice of one of the most unique figures of the 20th century, Quentin Crisp. Mr. Crisp died in 1999 at the age of 90. The city of New York, his adopted home for the last 18 years of his life, held a memorial for him soon after his death. A remarkable collection of people came to give their remembrances, and Pacifica was there to record the event. Today we bring you that event, along with selections from Quentin's one-man performance, An Evening with Quentin Crisp. In the 1920s, without the benefit of psychoanalysis, community centers, support groups, or self-help books, Quentin Crisp defied those who despised him for walking the streets of London looking, in his own words, undeniably like a homosexual person. His very existence, his survival, was his defiance. He was at the forefront of the struggle for gay and lesbian people simply to be. In short, he personified the line penned by Shakespeare, "To thine own self be true," and gave the ideals of civil disobedience and nonviolent protest new significance. The following program is a recording of the memorial service held in New York City, March 3, 2000, and explores the legacy of Mr. Crisp through the remembrances of his family and closest friends.
You can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York.
It was Quentin's lofty goal to meet everyone on earth before he died. In a sense, friends were a hindrance to this ambition. "I like my friends," he would say, "but I adore strangers."
He was outrageous and wild and all over the place, but he just had these exquisite manners.
Take a look around the room for a second at each other, and isn't it amazing that we have one variety of everything here? It is amazing, all because of one man, and I think that's beautiful.
There's a wild rumor going around London that the Queen Mother died 17 days ago, but they put her on ice until August for her 100th birthday. And I thought, isn't that just the sort of gossip that you would love to tell Quentin Crisp?
He was a great and gentle man with probably the most focused identity of our time. He gave so tirelessly to everyone he could and left quite a hole in our universe with his passing.
My name was, as you'll know if you read the book, my Christian name was Dennis in a time gone by.
My father, Louis, Quentin's elder brother, not elder brother, but 1 year older. I was his first child, and I could have been called Louise after my father, Louis, or Geraldine after his brother, Gerald. But I was named Denise after Dennis Quentin. Even one of my grand nephews is called Quentin. Quentin's family loved, respected, and admired him. And I'm really impressed to see so many people who felt the same about him. Well, I didn't get to see him very often because I lived in, and I still do, lived in South America, but we wrote to each other very often. And his letters were obviously very witty, full of wisdom. But something that perhaps not many know, they were very warm and caring. He used to sign them, Quentin, oh sorry, Uncle Dennis. When he still lived in England and working as an artist's model, for instance, he wrote, "They don't really need models, but I have become a sort of status symbol, a naked Cadillac." After a short visit to New York, he advised me, "Now that I am back, I am writing all about it for the English papers and advising everyone to leave for America at once." Finally, when his dream came true and he came to live in New York, and I was going through some difficult circumstances, times, his letter to me read, "If you possibly can, you should come here, though I am aware of your difficulties. Everyone is rich, and everyone is handsome, so you could marry almost anybody within a week." But it was the caring behind the one-liners that touched me. When my husband, my first husband, whom he had never met, died suddenly in 1973, his caring and tenderness was one of the things that helped assuage my grief. Well, I'm about to become emotional, which I'm sure my very English uncle Quentin would have abhorred, so I will leave it that way there, and we'll miss him.
I have now been to various places, including New York, which I'm able to tell you, if you don't know, is just like heaven.
Performance artist Penny Arcade.
I met Quentin almost immediately when he came to the East Village, but I didn't really get to know him until the late 80s, when Jack Eric Williams would bring him to all my shows. And I was stunned by Quentin when I finally did get to know him, because when I would just see him in the street, I thought, oh, that queen, you know. Well, I mean, I was raised by gay men, so, you know, I'm very dishy and judgmental. And when I did get to know him, I was stunned by his non-elitism, by his egalitarian spirit, that he was truly that person. And in 1993, for the last performance of Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore, he and Marianne Faithfull were in the show. And in the middle of the show, I asked Quentin if he would promise to live to be 100. And he said, "Yes, I promise I shall live to be 100, Miss Arcade." Shortly before that, he had named me as his anima figure. He called me up and he said, "Would it be all right with you if I name you as my soulmate for the London Sunday Telegraph?" And I said, "Yes," and I was, of course, incredibly pleased and honored, because, you know, I did know that Quentin and I shared a lot of things in common. There were all these different things that I thought we had in common that would make me his soulmate or his anima figure. Then I got mailed the page from the magazine. It was a Sunday magazine for the London Sunday Telegraph. And the quote from Quentin was, "Most people would be horrified to be publicly identified by me as their soulmate. But Miss Arcade is impervious to embarrassment." Somewhere in this time, Quentin came under a lot of fire from gay activists. At the time, I had a very aggressive attitude about gay politics because all my friends were dying. And by 1992, I had lost over 200 friends. And I often didn't understand Quentin's position on it. He would say, "Well, when I was young, syphilis was all the rage." And I did understand that, in fact, he was over 70, actually over 80 at that time. And I know that people stop changing when they're 25 or 30. So, I mean, to imagine somebody at his age, I would imagine that he had a position on things. And at that time, he said to me, because he would always say that gay people weren't real, and I had a problem with this, and he would say, "Well, if the opposite of gay is straight, then the opposite of straight is crooked. If the opposite of real is imaginary, I don't mind being an imaginary person, but I don't like being a crooked person." He called me up and he said, "Miss Arcade, I know I've always promised you to live to be 100 years old, but I was wondering if you would give me a dispensation so that I only had to live to be 90. And I said, "Well, Quentin, okay, You can die at 90 if you want, but it's only 2 years from now. I said, you can't leave the planet until you debrief us on this horrible so-called postmodern era. And he said, well, what's postmodern? And I said, I don't know, I don't believe in it. And he said, I don't believe in it either. And I want to say that Quentin's great legacy is in his writing, and that everyone can have a personal relationship with Quentin through his writing. And I encourage you, if you haven't read him, to read him, because he was what we all want to be. He grew up to be himself. And that is the greatest thing that anyone can achieve.
I mean, modern science is so unkind that one might live to be 90.
Director of the Quentin Crisp Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, Louis Coelani.
I'm not bragging, but merely brimming with joy when I say that Quentin wrote of our friendship. I can think of no higher compliment than to be immortally linked with Quentin through his books. Two of my favorite heroes are Quentin Crisp and Shakespeare's King Henry V. An odd pairing, for Quentin was as gentle as Henry was warlike. Henry's cause was to conquer nations through force and violence. Quentin's cause was to educate his oppressors through the art of self-expression. Yet as different as they were, both of my heroes found themselves outnumbered and fought against the odds. In a famous speech from Shakespeare's play, King Henry rouses his army by invoking two early Christian martyrs. Their names were Crispin and Crispian, and they were brothers. I like to think that as a young man, Quentin, who was often beaten bloody in the city streets merely for being himself, borrowed his last name, Crisp, from these brothers, these two courageous men, whose brains were dashed out on the streets of ancient Rome because of their beliefs. And Crispin, Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. From this day to the ending of the world, Quentin lives on through us, and we few here tonight, we band of brothers and sisters, we carry on.
Everyone is fascinating who can be got to talk about himself. This is the thing. Nothing is boring except a lie. If you can get people really to tell you the truth about themselves, then they're all interesting. More than that, they're all fascinating. So that as far as I'm concerned, if I've hungered for success, it's because it will bring me to more people. As far as I'm concerned, that's all there is. To spread yourself out to the utmost limit before the largest number of people.
The following two speakers are Quentin's longtime friends, Mr. Evan Thompson and Mrs. Joan Thompson.
In the summer of 1982, our son, Owen Thompson, who regrets that he can't be here tonight, but he's in rehearsal, asked Mr. Crisp if he would play Lady Bracknell in a production of The Importance of Being Earnest. And when he stopped laughing, he very graciously said yes, which is how I came to have the honor of directing Mr. Crisp the first time he appeared on any stage as a character other than himself. Although, of course, it really was himself. And, of course, I didn't really direct him. I sort of said, well, you come over and sit there, and then you say it, and the others will move around you. And he did, magnificently, with the most incredible understanding of every nuance that Oscar Wilde had written, with the great wit and with that underlying melancholy that was at the soul of all of Mr. Crisp's humor. And on one occasion, we were relaxing in the dressing room, and he said to me, You know, I could never really be an actor because I have no idea why any human being behaves as he does. But I do know where to put the semicolons.
Oh, well, not to cry. In that same production, I got myself appointed. I played Miss Prism to his Lady Bracknell, but I somehow got myself appointed as his dresser. And we were fond of each other even that long ago. I never called him anything but Mr. Crisp the entire 18 and a half years that I knew him well. And he never called me anything but Mrs. Thompson, except in that production, because the dresser, the movie of the dresser, was at the time very current, and we both seen it and loved it. He called me Norman. And, of course, I called him Sir. And that was the only first name that he ever called me. Anyway, just would like to end by saying to Mr. Crisp, hello, Mr. Crisp. This isn't Mrs. Norman Maine, but it is Norman, and good night.
Performance artist and impersonator Stephen Sorrentino.
I didn't realize how attached I was to Mr. Crisp. I got to live for a month with him. I got to survive for a month with him in Minneapolis when we filmed the movie Homo Heights. And I was a little embarrassed because in the movie I wore a dress, and Mr. Crisp and I always had a good relationship, and I was a regular Long Island kind of guy, and he was Mr. Crisp. And I put on the dress, and I said, I'm a little embarrassed, what do you think? And he looked close and said, I think you look quite cozy. So we spent a month in heels together. It was incredible. I would just like to say from the bottom of my heart that when he was put in hospital for the first time, and I was a part of that, and I apologized till the last time we saw each other, for years, like Miss Arcade, I had to apologize. I brought to the hospital a beautiful robe with a big Q on it. And he said to me, why are you so kind to me? And I thought, and I remember being a young man looking at the naked civil servant and saying, I can be an individual, I could be myself, because if a man like that has that kind of courage, and if that courage exists in a human being, then I certainly could be myself, no matter what. And I said, Mr. Crisp, without you, there would be no me. And he just smiled. So I think right now that there's a chair and a drink, a real drink, as he'd say, up in heaven, and he's looking down, and he would hate all this fuss. But I think he would stop for a second and say just one word, lovely.
Anxiety is in the future, and regret is in the past. And betrayal is in other people. But in you, there is only yourself. There is only your happiness.
Next we hear from dramatist Tim Fountain.
There was the obligatory lunch at Cafe 99, because I think the Cooper Diner was closed at the time. And he sat in the window, and he received his meal free as recompense for sitting in the window. And he held forth for another 2 hours. Later, as we tottered home through the snow, I told him that he was contractually obliged to approve the script I was writing. In typical Quentin style, he said, I accept whatever you write. And he did. I spoke to him a couple of weeks before he died, and I asked him if he'd received the play, and he said, I've received it, but I haven't read it. He was far more interested in telling me about his hernia, which he said proudly was as big as an orange. Quentin never got to see the play, but I think he received word of what a big success it was. Night after night, an incredible cross-section of people, from Kensington ladies to Camden queens, sat rapt by his words and stories and Beck's portrayal of him. I think they marveled at the sheer courage with which he lived his life. As Bett said in a tribute to him at the Royal Albert Hall, never forget that Quentin Crisp was out in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. He stayed out in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. And that's an incredible thing. When he passed away, some of the English press, and indeed some of the English gay press, tried to portray him as, to use Quentin's own phrase, a sad, lonely, embittered old queen. They were so wrong. I can't think of anyone who suffered as much and was less bitter or more generous with his time.
The only advantage of being an outsider to such an extent was that every day, just to live at all, was a kind of triumph.
Quentin's former agent and editor of The Wit and Wisdom of Quentin Crisp, Guy Kettlehack.
Asked to suggest the remedy for a broken heart, Quentin replied, "The remedy is to learn not to value love because it is requited. If you have love to give, you give it, and you give it where it is needed. Once you have this idea in your head, the idea of a broken heart will disappear." Asked if he believed in God, well, in a conversation with someone he knew would not take offense, his answer was simply no. But in his response to the question at a performance he gave in New Orleans, he gave an answer which, when I have read it to various Jesuit, Buddhist, and Orthodox Jewish friends, has met with their instantaneous and awestruck agreement. It's the closest to a manifesto I've ever heard Quentin make. Here it is. Do you believe in God? Well now, the last time you know who was mentioned, I began by saying I wouldn't like to say anything that gave offense. And someone in the audience said, why stop now? But this is still something that worries me, so if at any moment anyone finds anything I say offensive, they have only to jump up and down, make a scene, and we will stop. I believe, like most people, not that of which logic can convince me, but what my nature inclines me to believe. This is so of nearly everybody. I am unable to believe in a God susceptible to prayer as petition. It does not seem to me to be sufficiently humble to imagine that whatever force keeps the planets turning in the heavens is going to stop what it's doing to give me a bicycle with 3 speeds. But if God is the universe that encloses the universe, or if God is the cell within the cell, or if God is the cause behind the cause, then this I accept absolutely. And if prayer is a way of aligning your body with the forces that flow through the universe, then prayer I accept. But there is a worrying aspect about the idea of God. Like witchcraft or the science of the zodiac or any of these other things, the burden is placed elsewhere. This is what I don't like. You see, to me, you are the heroes of this hour. I do not think the earth was ever meant to be your home. I do not see the sky as a canopy held over your head by cherubs or see the ground as a carpet laid at your feet. You used to live an easy lying down life in the sea, but your curiosity and your courage prompted you to lift your head out of the sea and gasp this fierce element in which we live. They are seated on Mars with their little green arms folded, saying, we can be reasonably certain there is no life on Earth because there the atmosphere is oxygen, which is so harsh that it corrupts metal. But you learned to breathe it. Furthermore, you crawled out of the sea and you walked up and down the beach for centuries, until your thigh bones were thick enough to walk on land. It was a mistake, but you did it. Once you have this view of your past, not that it was handed to you, but that you did it, then your view of the future will change. This terror you have of the atom bomb will pass. Something will arise which will breathe radiation if you learn to breathe oxygen. So you don't have to worry. Don't keep looking into the sky to see what is happening. Embrace the future. All you have to do about the future is what you did about the past. Rely on your curiosity and your courage and ride through the night.
When you have your style, you lay it at the feet of your neighbor. You don't get better than them. You don't put your style across other people. You offer it to them. It is not a question of getting the better of other people. It is not a question of being more peculiar than other people. When I was in Woking, a man said, all you want us to do is wear funny clothes. I want you to wear funny clothes if you're funny people.
American composer and writer Ned Rorem.
No one was remotely like Quentin, with his extreme politeness, his unbitchy wit, and his basic common sense in the form of aphorism. With his death, the world weighs less.
Why do you consider it to be more fulfilling to be recognized for yourself rather than what you create? Because if it's for what you create, what good it will do you? You will be standing in a room at a party and someone will say, who's that over there? And the reply will be, apparently he's a famous sculptor. What good is this? And people are always saying to me, perhaps people want their work to be recognized after their death. What good is that?
Actor John Hurt.
To conclude anything about Quentin, one would have to go to that which is essential, the essence of Quentin. He was a philosopher, and he is the only philosopher, to my knowledge, that actually lived his philosophy. He was a major, major figure of the 20th century, and he wasn't like anyone. He was literally unique.
All my life is given to the world. I don't have a life. I have very few hours in which I'm doing anything except sleeping or being with the world. Now, this I like. I've done it myself, and this is a life that I live.
You have been listening to highlights from the memorial service honoring visionary thinker Quentin Crisp. Thanks to Philip Ward, estate executor and organizer of the Quentin Crisp Foundation, www.crisperanto.org. John Hurt's tape courtesy of Professor Richard Connolly, additional music composed by Evan Lurie for the film Homo Heights, which co-starred Mr. Crisp. The memorial program to Mr. Crisp was produced by Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials that we used, go online at www.fromthevaultradio.org or call Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producers Mark Torres, production coordinator Edgar Toledo, outreach by Sean Dellis, business manager Mariana Berkovich, and customer service Arlene Chang. Special thanks to our volunteers Alan Carmen and Shailendra Shakur. If you're in the Los Angeles area and would like to volunteer for From the Vault, please go to our website to find out how. Our theme music is courtesy of Los Angeles-based Parallel. For more information on Parallel and other music used within the program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.
This week on From the Vault Remembered, what we generally do is we actually bring in someone to talk about the topic for the week. This week's topic is actually Quentin Crisp, who had come out in the early 1900s. In 1920s, he came out and led a very out lifestyle, became a legend. And we're honoring his life this week on From the Vault. And what we normally do is Brian DeShazer, the director of the Pacifica Archive, is our host for the program. But this week, I'm sitting in just for this half hour. My name is Christopher Sprinkle. I produce From the Vault. And I'm going to talk to Brian DeShazer because he's going to be our special guest this week because he had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Crisp back in the late 90s and also produced a memorial program that went on to win awards for Pacifica on the memorial of Quentin Crisp. And so I want to bring in Brian right now and ask him about that first time that you were able to meet Quentin Crisp here in Los Angeles.
Thanks, Christopher. So in Los Angeles, early 1999, Quentin Crisp was coming to Los Angeles with his one-man performance, An Evening with Quentin Crisp. And I've been trying to get an interview with him because in the Pacifica Radio Archives, I was new to the archive, but found Quentin Crisp audio. I'm including a 1978 interview by Jessica Schumann, which included some of the clips from this actual performance. So I went to the theater and, you know, met with his manager, who was sort of, you know, distanced me and said that after the performance, I might, you know, ask again if I could, you know, get an interview. And I brought recording equipment with me that I didn't really even know how to work, but at least I knew which button to push. So I get to the theater and I actually sat in the front row by myself, you know, in the center, and I sort of like stared at Quentin constantly as he sat, and we were only maybe about 6 feet away. Well, by intermission, you know, the manager comes up to me and says, Mr. Crisp would like to see you backstage. And I don't think that Mr. Crisp knew that I was someone that was trying to get, you know, an audience with him.
Did he just think you were cute? What was going on?
Well, we don't know. I would like to think so. So I think it was because I was staring at him so hard. So I went backstage and, you know, he was just off in the wing by himself and, you know, he was, you know, had a glass of scotch and, you know, I sat down and asked him some questions and we commented on his, you know, his brooch and he commented on whatever I was wearing and, you know, his scarves and his hats. And so he did, you know, honor me with an interview that I did, you know, at another time, you know, another night when he wasn't so tired. And it was really an incredible experience because he did mean so much to me in my own coming out. And, you know, The Naked Civil Servant was sort of the first film that I'd seen about a man who lived an out lifestyle. So he really was sort of a personal thing for me to, you know, use my workspace to go out and find a man that was, you know, sort of iconic to me. And it turned out that I did get that sort of personal relationship with him, you know, backstage. And he held my hand with one hand and drank the scotch with the other hand. And we really sort of just talked about life, you know, nothing major. So then I did the interview, and then, you know, after the interview, I was, again, I didn't have interviewing skills, wasn't a journalist, and was sort of, you know, rambling through the interview, much more concentrating on my questions on the page than looking at him and listening. I think he said something really important, and I just sort of brushed it over and went on to the next question. But he was very sweet, you know, signed my book of The Naked Civil Servant, and was, you know, very happy. And then he, you know, later that year, he passed away, almost 6 months later, I think. So in doing my research for the program and producing the memorial service, I found in the archive this 1978 interview with Jessica Schumann, which I think is really the most profound and most prolific recording because it really does have clips of his performance, which are very rare, and also the interview, you know, the personal talk one-on-one of where that art came from. Basically, he did the same performance for 25, 30 years, and it just changed, the dialogue just changed a little bit. But you can find from 1978... you know, lines that he said in 1999 when I saw him. It's the same show. But what was the first half was the same. That was scripted. The second half was all Q&A from the audience, and that changed constantly. So in the recording with the 1978 interview that we're about to hear, you can hear the audience questions, which are very dated almost. You know, they're very interesting to listen to of what somebody might have asked in 1978, and then I was at the same performance in 1999, and heard different kinds of questions, but his answers were the same.
Well, let's go ahead and hear the interview that Jessica Schumann did in 1978 with Quentin Crisp.
He was reluctantly born on Christmas Day in 1908. To his dismay, he found himself to be the son of middle-class, middle-brow, middling parents who lived in Sutton, a suburb of London, England. After an uneventful childhood, he was sent, between the ages of 14 and 18, to a school which was like a cross between a monastery and a prison. There he learned nothing that could be useful to him in adulthood except how to bear injustice. His ignorance of everything but this and his ambiguous appearance made any career impossible except in the arts. And this describes the early life of Quentin Crisp, also known and perhaps best known as the Naked Civil Servant. I'm Jessica Schumann, and today Quentin Crisp is my guest. Welcome.
Thank you.
You perhaps best exemplify Shakespeare's tenet that the world is a stage and we but players. Your whole life in recent years is an acting out of who you are. Perhaps you talk about how you evolved who you are, how you evolved this style that you've become notorious for. And you've said that it's certainly not famous, it's definitely notorious, whether you dabbled in other lifestyles, whether you had other images which you donned and then threw off because they didn't suit you, like a hat that didn't quite fit your head.
Well, I did, of course, experiment to some extent, because everybody does. In the beginning, I was entirely unsure of myself, especially when I was at school. And when I was young, I alternately confirmed and denied my existence. But after a while, you can't keep that up. You have to make up your mind whether you're going to try and make yourself over to the world's opinion of what you should be like, or whether you're going to stay with what you find that you are. And what made the world cross was to find that I was so effeminate, what at school was merely thought to be feeble. I didn't want to play games, I didn't want to get hurt, and this annoyed everybody very much. And I would sometimes pretend that I was playing games and run round a field and try to get dirty. And then on other days I would think, no, this is nonsense. So I would lounge about saying, what is football? And so on. And it wasn't until I left school and went out into the world that I thought, I must make up my mind. And then I decided that I would act out all the elements of my nature. The moment comes for everybody when he has to do deliberately what he used to do by mistake. And I suppose I realized this at about the age of 25. And from that moment onward, it was all clear to me what I should do. I should adopt an appearance which told everybody what they seemed so desperately to want to know. Because if there are only two people left in the world alive, one thing will live with them, and that is the curiosity of the one about the sex life of the other. And so since this seemed to matter to everybody, to an extent where because I wore makeup and dyed my hair, the crowds followed me through the streets to the extent where you could not get the traffic through the streets, we have to say that this is something they wanted to know. So I made it possible for them to know instantly, when they saw me, exactly who and what I was.
But Quentin Crisp is a lot more than those outward appearance factors.
Yes. Now, of course, I've gone to the very edge of exhibitionism, because inevitably the time comes when you find yourself moving from statement to protest. You find yourself doing things not to please yourself, but to annoy the neighbors. And you have to move back again, because it is as absurd to try to offend the neighbors as it is to try to ingratiate yourself with them. What you have to do, as I see it, is to decide what you would be like if there were nobody else in the world. What would you do if you had only yourself to consider? And once you've decided that, you do it, and you be it, and you stay with it for an entire lifetime. And then you have a core, you have some certitude inside yourself about the rightness of what you're doing in your own eyes.
You've said that lifestyle for you is a religion.
lifestyle for me is, yes, it is a way of going on, so that it would cover everything, so that if a crisis were to arise, I could say, is what I am doing or saying or wearing or thinking compatible with my lifestyle?
I would imagine that it would be harder and harder for you and for many other people to find a sense of individuality. There is so much flamboyance. There is so much extravagance. There is so much theatricality. Certainly in Los Angeles, the tinsel town of the world, I'm sure you've noted that walking down the boulevard in Hollywood, that everybody is out to show off and to outdo their neighbor.
Yes, this is true. And audiences have said to me, what would you do if you found yourself outstyled? Well, of course, there's no such thing. You don't have to be more outrageous than other people. You don't have to do anything about other people. You never make any comparison between yourself and others. You simply have to be more and more like yourself. And so, of course, if you look into your soul and find that you're ordinary, then ordinary you must be. But if possible, you must be so ordinary that you can imagine someone saying, come to my party and bring your humdrum friend, and that means you.
When you looked into your soul, when you searched the interior realm of your being, what did you find? Can you put that in words?
I found that most of my mental characteristics were feminine, in spite of my body being masculine. And this is what worried everybody so much. My problem from the beginning was not a sexual problem, it's what Jan Morris calls a gender problem. It was a personality problem. And this worries people very little now. When the young people say to me, well, what was it all about? And I say, well, I did dye my hair. They say, and then? Because it makes no difference to them. But I come from a world where the difference between the sexes was so great that there were whole vocabularies which were suitable for men to use. No man in the middle classes of England, when I was young, would have said anything was lovely or marvellous. There were the clothes you could wear. There were the movements you could make, even the facial movements. No man ever rolled his eyes or smiled from ear to ear. Englishmen have very small facial movements. And so anything else was what my friends call a dead giveaway. And you had to learn all this, or else do without it. You had to do the things which were natural to you and lump the consequences. But there were whole occupations which were women's work. My father wouldn't have boiled a kettle because it was woman's work, and that meant degrading, which is a pretty terrible state of affairs. And I'm very pleased that even in England, the sexes are more friendly now than they were in a time gone by. But still, to this day, Englishmen do not really like the society of women.
What if you've been born into a different society where equality was accepted and no one really was too concerned over appearance, over gender identification, a rather polymorphous, perverse society? How would your life have been different if no one really cared whether you liked to sew or you liked to cook, whereas others did not?
Oh, undoubtedly my personality would have been much less shrill. I would have been able, as you say, to do these things without doing them in defiance of the world. And I would probably have been much more pleasant to know. The trouble with a lot of people who have a personality problem is not that people dislike the personalities they manifest. It's that people get bored with the fact that they never talk about anything else. And this would not have applied to me if there had been no problem.
I would imagine, though, if you stripped away all the antagonism, though, you would be left with, well, without a raison d'être, perhaps.
Well, of course, it did become the meaning of my life. That's quite true. It became, in the beginning, a crusade. And I thought that I represented all the effeminate people in the world, which, of course, is rubbish. I merely represented myself. But it does give, did give, in my case, an interest to my life that a lot of people may otherwise not have. To live through a single day was a kind of triumph.
I think that would heighten your existence tremendously. In a way, you're fortunate, then.
In a way, I'm fortunate. All outsiders of any kind do have this fact that they bring to bear on every situation all they have, instead of merely taking it or leaving it, not really considering it very deeply. Every person you meet is a potential antagonist, and you spend your time making them over, working away at them, winning them over. Your life is one long, tentative flirtation with the world.
When you talk about style, I'm tempted to think of artifice, guise, masks, and I'm wondering whether you see these two concepts, these two ideas, as linked in any way.
Oh, I think they are, what I mean by style is the opposite of this. Mr. Wilde said that in matters of great importance, it wasn't sincerity that mattered, but style. And this to me means that he wasn't truly a stylist, because to me, sincerity and style are the same thing. Just as in literature, style is not a question of raining down encrusted, bejeweled passages on rather banal material. Style in literature is removing all the words which don't say what you really mean. And in the same way, in style in life, you have to find some way of leaving nothing of yourself to doubt, so that everybody does understand who you are, what you are, what you mean by what you say.
So in other words, you pare down everything that's non-essential, and you get to that core, the economy, that expresses your inner essence through style.
That's right.
That's not the way the word is usually used, I don't think.
This is true, and this is a problem, and this I do have to explain in the theater, and I try to explain it in various ways.
One of the things that I think is utterly wonderful about the message, and indeed you come to America with a message that isn't dissimilar from our recent fascination with do your own thing and realize your potential movement that many psychologists today have adhered to, but you say it differently. And one of the things that you said, and I heard really loud and clear, is that what you are has to be more wonderful than what you do, which strips away and really attacks one of the foundations of American life, which is so identified with doing as opposed to being. And you come across and you say, listen, we need to pay attention to the being, because that, those acts, really is what counts.
Mm. Yes, this is the essential part to me. You have to, if possible, get a profession where what you are is more important than what you do. And above all, what never matters is what you accumulate.
Possessions.
Possessions are a complete waste of time. You only surround yourself with those things which represent you.
So what do you have in your house that represents you, in your little one room that you say?
Well, in the one room, I have nothing which isn't useful. There are no pictures. There are no ornaments of any kind, because I like to reduce my life to the essentials of staying alive.
If you look at history, what fictional character, what historical character do you feel the most kinship to?
Well, I've been asked that before, and I can't think of any, though of course we all take just as we take from fashion magazines things which we've always waited to see, and then one day they turn up and we say, that's what I want, now I can buy it, now wear it for the rest of my life. So, of course, when you meet people or when you see history, you think, that's what I would like to do, and then you try to do it. So we are all learning from the world. It would be nonsense to say you sit with your eyes shut and your hands over your ears and think who you are. You must take something from the world. But I can't remember ever saying of any particular character that I longed to be them or I would have liked to have lived in their circumstances. When I was a child, certainly the people that I was most interested in were the movie stars, particularly the great women movie stars. And there were more movie stars then than there are now because the world has got cross with the idea of stardom. And I'm asked sometimes what went wrong, why there are now no movie stars and no stage stars. And of course the answer is that you got rid of them.
Because you wanted a more democratic kind of process.
That's right, you wanted the democratic process, and you were mistaken.
We were mistaken, eh?
Yeah.
What do you think we've lost?
You've lost the thing which the movies were able to do that no other form of entertainment could do, which is to exploit physical style, physical idiom, because you can see so much of movie stars. You can see them move their hands and their feet. You can see them move their eyebrows. Therefore, you can see the way their bodies express themselves, whereas you can't on the stage. Everyone's a long way off, and you're sitting there with your opera glasses saying, oh, she's sad 'cause he's dead, but it's all a long way off. In fact, you're not quite sure, and he gets up, and you think, no, he's not dead. Whereas in the movies, you see it all. You see everything they think.
I sense a preoccupation, I have to return to it, with the gesture, with mannerisms, with physical posture and gait. And I still am trying to find out beyond that, if I were to keep probing with my scalpel, my verbal scalpel, does the private Quentin Crisp differ? Is there a private self beneath all this concern with appearance?
No, there's none.
There is none.
There is none. What audiences see is all there is. They know me at the end of the evening as well as people who've known me for 50 years.
They do. Mm-hmm. Just a bubble underneath all this.
Yes.
Just the nothingness, a core of nothingness beneath all this.
There's only myself beneath it all. And everything I do and all the movements and all the phraseology, they are all only an expression of myself.
Mark Twain once said that humor does not come from joy, but rather from sorrow. That the true humorist really has angst underneath the tongue-in-cheek kind of parley. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think to some extent. Unlike wit, which is purely verbal, which is an arrangement of the words, humor consists of having at least two views of the same situation. Well, this already means that you will become diminished by humor yourself, because as well as thinking, I have been wronged, these people have been unkind to me, you also have to see whether they were absolutely at their wit's end. To them, they may have been behaving in an extremely forbearing way in treating you in the way that you consider outrageous. And it is these two views which make humor. It is seeing that while one person is saying, I have been appallingly treated, another person is saying, I did the very best I could. I thought I was going to hit him, but I only said, I think you'd better leave now.
How does this relate to the material of the humorist? I'm not clear.
Well, you see, you have to express, if possible, all the points of view that are possible about one situation. And this means that in a story, both points of view will be given. Mm-hmm. The person, the heroic saga of someone's life, as seen from their own point of view, will be described, and at the same time, the terrible fool that this person is making of himself in the eyes of others must also be described. This is the essence of humor. So, as Mr. Twain said, at the same time that you are laughing, you are seeing yourself as absurd because you see yourself from outside. as well as from inside.
That statement that you've just made is reasonably straight on. A lot of the kinds of statements you come out with, however, during the course of spending an evening with you are all tongue-in-cheek. And sometimes when I was sitting and watching you, I was wondering what would happen if he took his tongue out of his cheek.
Ah, I never say what I don't mean. It's only the way the things are expressed that seem to other people to be a joke. Aphorisms are a waste of time if they don't express a truth. So that whatever I say, all these quotes that appear in the papers are an expression of what I really think. It's only that the words have been fitted together so as to make a paradox or an aphorism. But nothing is really funny unless it is partly true.
I see. So everything that I've heard you say, I can essentially take at face value and just understand that you have a rather unique style of putting the words together.
Yes.
If a young person came to spend an evening with you theatrically, they would have heard you say that cohabitation is a big mistake, that you find the nesting instinct in human beings a bit funny. You probably would have had a big chuckle if you had watched people filing on to Noah's Ark in the pattern, the dance of the twos. What if they take that at face value?
Well, you see, there it is. It is the extreme statement of a truth. Of course, people will always live in pairs, but they must be warned that it has its disadvantages. And when I say that the disadvantage is that if two people share a territory, they will be left with the things about which they disagree. This is true. The things that will stay with them, the things about which they don't remind themselves, are, if they don't remind themselves, they're the things about which they disagree. What they talk about is the things about which they disagree. When someone comes to you and you say, how is your marriage going on? They don't give you a list of all the things that about which they agree with their husbands. They say, what do you think he's done now?
You've just been listening to a recording from the Pacifica Radio Archives, produced in 1978 at Los Angeles' KPFK. That was Jessica Schumann interviewing the visionary thinker Quentin Crisp. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials that we used, go online at www.fromthevaultradio.org or call Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres. Production coordinator, Edgar Toledo. Outreach by Sean Dellis. Business manager, Mariana Berkovich. And customer service, Arlene Chang. Special thanks to our volunteers, Alan Carmen and Shailendra Shakur. If you're in the Los Angeles area and would like to volunteer for From the Vault, please go to our website to find out how. Our theme music is courtesy of Los Angeles-based Parallel. For more information on Parallel and other music used within the program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.